From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. This morning, Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee tried and failed to slow down the confirmation of Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett, who appears to be on track for the high court before the November 3rd election. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales joins us with the latest. And Claudia, today is day four of Coney Barrett's confirmation. How far apart are Republicans and Democrats on this committee over the sheer pace of this confirmation hearing? It's really going pretty fast.
They are moving as quickly as they can. Republicans are. Both sides remain very far apart. Just this morning, as you had mentioned, Democrats were able to delay today's proceedings. They did that by about 2 hours. And they're hearing now from a series of experts. And Barrett is not appearing. So it's just a reminder of how these two sides are so opposed right now. Democrats don't want to see this nomination move forward, but they also have very limited tools in their disposal to stop this process. Republicans have been steadfast in their mission to approve Barrett to the court before Election Day, and even as much of the country is already in the midst of early voting. So this is moving on schedule for Republicans, even with the Democrats' attempts to stall with a vote set for next Thursday to move her nomination from the committee to the full Senate floor.
What's been some of the analysis of how Coney Barrett has come across this week?
Well, surprisingly, even with this bitter partisanship on display right now, this hasn't been as combative and contentious as we saw during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings from 2018. Democratic senators told reporters last night that Barrett isn't as combative as Kavanaugh, so that's taken a lot of the heat out of this wave of hearings this time. That say they've complained repeatedly that Barrett has been evasive. She's declined to talk about how she might rule in the future on certain cases. And she's also dodged questions on climate change and other matters that are of importance right now. But in light of that, Republicans say Barrett and her background is still resonating with the American public.
She did have some things to say, though, about the case coming before the high court this week after the election, challenging the Affordable Care Act. What stood out there?
So she hasn't said she'll recuse herself from that case. She was grilled extensively on this. Democrats say Trump is putting her on the court to overturn it. And Democrats say Barrett auditioned for the court through a series of critical pieces against the ACA. We should note, again, that this case will be before the court just a week after the election. And she hasn't said this week, however, that she's on a mission to destroy it. But still, it remains unclear how she could rule here, and says she hasn't looked at the issues yet and doesn't know how she will either.
There was also this moment yesterday in an exchange with Senator and Democratic vice presidential candidate Kamala Harris, who pressed Coney Barrett on her beliefs about whether COVID-19 was infectious, whether smoking causes cancer, and whether climate change is real.
I will not express a view on a matter of public policy, especially one that is politically controversial, because that's inconsistent with the judicial role, as I have explained.
Thank you, Judge Barrett. And you've made your point clear that you believe it's a debatable point.
And Harris was responding there and noting that Coney Barrett is saying climate change is a debatable point. What are other Democrats saying about moments like this? And what are Republicans also saying in response?
Democrats are using this as ammunition that Barrett has been evasive, and using this as an example of claims that the American public still doesn't know Barrett well enough to know she's a right fit for the Supreme Court. And this ties into another concern just raised by Democrats in today's hearing, claiming Barrett has yet to submit comprehensive information to the committee about her background, because, again, this is such a rushed process. And even Democrats have conceded they haven't had enough time to dig into Barrett's background to bring an even more comprehensive look at this nominee and how she could shift the court. So in terms of her asking these questions, Harris and others, they feel like there haven't been enough answers. But Republicans say that she's presented a complete picture enough to be approved to the highest court.
Okay, so what's the timeline for the committee to vote on her nomination and then the full Senate? So we know two Republicans, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, are potential no votes. But even still, is this a done deal?
This appears to be a done deal from here. Of course, a week is eons away these days, so we can't say for sure what's going to happen. However, the committee has set that vote for next week to vote her nomination out to the full Senate floor. So the full Senate could take this up sometime in the remaining days of the month. And in terms of who might vote against it, yes, those two, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, are two potential no votes. Democrats are still hoping that they'll have more Republicans flip and vote against this and perhaps derail the effort. But right now, it looks like this could be a done deal.
Claudia Grisales is NPR congressional reporter. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Donald Trump Jr. is campaigning for the president today in northern Arizona, launching an official effort to recruit Native American voters. But elsewhere in the state near Arizona's border with Mexico, Native Americans have been protesting the Trump administration and its ramped up construction of the border wall ahead of the election. On Monday, state troopers tear gassed Native protesters after they blocked a road near the construction site. Eleven people were arrested, including some children. The wall construction crosses through Tohono O'odham land, and members of the tribal nations say the work is destroying their history and their water. Let's bring in V. Lewis, who is a member of the tribe and a teacher. She lives in Tucson, and she's here with us now on a Skype line. V, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
And now, you weren't at that protest, but I know you're deeply involved with this issue. What's your reaction when you hear that sound and when you see videos of that encounter with state troopers?
It's traumatizing. It's harmful. It's hurtful. And it also reminds me of Standing Rock, North Dakota, when the same battle of the Lakota, Nakota, and Dakota people had to stand for their clean water and a pipeline going under the Missouri River. It brings up a lot of that.
Yeah, and we'll talk about the environmental impact here for just a minute, but I do want to say that a spokesman for the state troopers said that the protesters were given a five-minute warning to disperse before the officers moved in. But V, many members of your tribal nation live on both sides of the border. They've been protesting this construction of this border wall for months now. Do you feel like anyone is listening?
Maybe more so now than ever, but no. Before this, there has been many indigenous folks that have tried to take things to court, to do it the quote-unquote orthodox way, and to get it recognized in the legislative with the administration. And no one has heard any of our cries and our despair for the earth and what's happening to our lands itself. And this is the first time that I've heard, and that all of us have recognized, that they are taking heed and asking us for interviews and coming down to the actual quote-unquote border and being able to start sharing our story and putting it out there.
And you say quote-unquote border because to your people there is none. It doesn't really exist. It's a false construction.
There is no word, correct. There is no word for border in our language, nor did we ever ask for a border. That's dividing of our people. There's four different tribes within one nation: the Acoma O'odham, the Tohono O'odham, Hiachit O'odham, and the Sonoran O'odham. The Sonoran O'odham are the O'odham that are in Mexico, and that border wall crossed those people. Hmm.
To build the wall, construction crews have had to destroy burial sites. They've cut down protected saguaro cactuses in the region. Right. Native people have also said that the work is draining precious water resources in what is a very, very arid landscape. Tell me more about the environmental impact of the wall on your traditional lands.
So to paint a very true, vivid picture, you're seeing the four-legged, which are like deer out there, being stuck at the wall and eventually dying there because they know their path of migration and they're still trying to follow it. And there's a wall there now that's blocking them from migrating through that area to get the nutrients and the water that they need to continue their path of migration. The natural spring sacred site that we have is being drained to utilize for water to be mixed with the concrete for the wall itself. That is just, every time I have to say that, I'm mortified, I'm hurt, I'm just taken back that this is actually logical for the administration to think that that's okay. We have in our sacred spring the Sonoit mud turtle, And if that water goes, that mud turtle goes. And that mud turtle is only found in that sacred site that spring in the quote-unquote Oregon Park National Monument, also known as Hiatchet Autumn Land.
Well, there was some significant news last Friday when a federal court said that the president couldn't use that military money to fund the new border wall. That was supposed to stop construction. We'll see what happens with that. But when you hear about the president's son coming to Arizona to hold a Native Americans for Trump event, you know, what's your reaction to that?
Can you use profanity here? No, it's not something that as I feel that where we stand, I stand, is that something that we're willing to embrace or accept or hear out? Our cries are being heard right now in what you have just played, that take back. And we're not standing for it. And so for any administration or any part of it to try to come and rally for indigenous or native folks to side in the vote, I think that's ridiculous. It's actually laughable at this point because we know better.
That's V. Lewis, member of the Tohono O'odham Nation, protesting the border wall construction along the U.S.-Mexico border. Thank you so much for your time, V. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
There's a new documentary in theaters and available on Amazon Prime starting tomorrow. It's a powerful look at the toll incarceration takes on a family and how one woman can make a difference. The film is called Time, and it tells the story of Rob and Fox Rich, high school sweethearts who married and started a family in the early 90s. But during a time of desperation, the two made a failed attempt to rob a bank. Both were sentenced to prison. Fox served 3.5 years, and Rob was sentenced to 60 years without the possibility of parole. After Fox Rich was released, she spent the next 2 decades working to free Rob while raising the couple's 6 boys. In the film, Fox reflects on those years.
Time is when you look at pictures from when your babies were small, and then you look at them and you see that they have mustaches and beards, and that the biggest hope that you had was that before they turned into men, they would have a chance to be with their father.
Rob Fox was granted clemency in 2018 after serving 21 years in prison. Once again, the film is called Time, and Fox and Rob Rich join us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Fox, I want to start with you. A lot of the film is video that you shot yourself over the years when Rob was incarcerated. Did you shoot that video so that you could show Rob what was going on while he was in prison?
You know, I actually picked up my camera, Tanya, because when I married Rob, it was the happiest moment of my life. And I was so excited that we had started a family. I wanted to document every aspect of it. 6 months into marriage, we found ourselves facing 297 years in prison. And so I wanted to capture those moments so that whenever we could move past this, we could hold on to some of those moments together and they wouldn't be a total loss for Rob.
Mm. Rob, you had a lot of material there over the years that you were able to see. What did you think as you saw those images of all of those events that took place while you were in prison?
It was a bittersweet kind of moment for me. You know, one, just realizing how much time had managed to escape us. At the same time, sweet, and knowing that it was finally over, or at least that phase of what we were experiencing was finally over.
Yeah, you know, the big timestamp were the twins, because,
yeah.
Fox, you were pregnant with the twins when he went away to prison, and then we got to watch you go through raising them, and then your other timestamp was like, I want him out of prison before the twins turn 18 years old.
Yes.
This film was directed by Garrett Bradley. How easy or difficult was it to open your home and really bare your soul to filmmakers? I mean, what did you think when she first approached you about making a film?
You know, I just was honored because, one, just to have someone as young and talented as Garrett Bradley is, have a desire to tell our story, which is not just me and Rob's story, but the story of 2.3 million Americans that are incarcerated and their families. More so when we connected for the first time, I knew that our family was in love with her and that through that love, we would be able to tell one of the greatest love stories of all time, a story of radical love and resilience.
The robbery that got both of you sent to prison was to fund a hip-hop clothing store. One of the other striking things about this film is that we see what remorse looks like. Your pain, your children's pain. How many times over the years did you ask yourself, what were you thinking?
You know, I think we concluded a long time ago that we as human beings have to give ourselves rooms to make the not so good choices and still know that we can be okay in knowing that I'm not the worst thing I've ever done. One of the most powerful moments for me was when Rob reminded us of what happened to us. And he says, baby, we lost our confidence because of the action we had made, but we got to forgive ourselves. We made a bad choice, Fox. We're not bad people. And so when you can settle into that, you must, as a formerly incarcerated person, not buy into I'm bad or I'm less than because I'm or the labeling of convicted felon, because it will really take you down a road. You got to love yourself enough to forgive yourself so that others, you feel like you have earned the forgiveness of others. And that's what Rob and I and our family tried to do, be better than the worst thing that we have done.
Mm. Rob, the love that Fox has for you, I mean, it kind of leapt out of the screen.
Wow. Crone. I mean, that's the only thing that really got me about this film of Garrett Bradley's is that she opens it up with me croning the love of this man.
It definitely is felt like it's palpable. I think anyone watching this knows it and understands it. Mm. But I want to know, Rob, did you feel it in prison? And was that part of what got you through?
I definitely felt Fox's love. It was able to penetrate through prison walls, and was so thankful to hear when the film came out, one of her speaking engagements where she was talking to a group of young ladies and she was talking to them about identifying their significant other. And she said that whoever that someone is, that someone should be who you would be if you were in the male body. So for her to think that I am her and she is, me.
You shouldn't even have me blushing after 34 years. Isn't this ridiculous?
That's amazing. But Rob, did you ever feel like during your time in prison that you might not get released? I mean, 60 years without parole was your sentence.
It was, but my commitment to Fox and my family was greater than that. And I had committed and made a vow before the altar that I would be married to her till death do us part. And part of that is also making sure that nothing or no one would take us under. And that he included the system of Louisiana's criminal justice system. Dying in prison or not getting out of prison was never for either of us.
No.
There's so many feelings I think that people will have when they watch the film. We see in the film over the next two decades, Fox, you calling judges, talking to secretaries. At one point, you talk about a high-priced lawyer that took thousands of dollars and then told you that nothing could be done. And all I kept thinking about was something you said earlier about so many others who are incarcerated and don't have Foxes in their lives.
You know, and it is a tragedy, I think, what incarceration does to a family, period. And it's not even about having Foxes in their lives. They have to be their own Fox. And Rob had to be his own Rob. This was definitely a collaborative effort. I just think one of the most powerful comments to me was Lincoln's when he said that determine a thing must be done and then we shall find a way. We as citizens, everyday human beings, we have to determine that a thing must be done. Rob and I always knew we would restore our family. It was just a matter of what way would be available to us.
Hmm. As I mentioned earlier, one of the most bittersweet parts of the film are your sons. I mean,
aren't they adorable? Oh my God. I love those boys. They make us so proud.
But we're not talking one or two or three. You have a house full of boys. How did you keep Rob alive for them to be like a real presence in the family?
I think that Rob just did it for himself because he was determined. Well, you know, your fathering technique.
Right.
Yeah.
I know for me, one big thing is an article that I read in a Men's Health magazine once, and they spoke about the fact that the average American father spends about 8 hours per month engaged with their children. And when I thought about the fact that we were afforded at least 2 visits per month, each visit could last, you know, in excess of 6 to 7 hours per visit. When I looked at that, I figured, I said, well, I could contend with the average father. If they're only being able to put 8 hours of engagement time into their children, then I could manage to put the same amount of time into my kids. Hence, started my journey of fathering from behind bars.
And father, he does. It has just been, you know, people like to give me the credit because I'm the one that they see. But he is like Charlie on the other line telling the angels what to do. Because when those rascals would try to be little young men on me, I would say, you just wait to visit. You're going to go see your father this weekend, you know. And just think now, you take them to visit. And it wasn't like their father has never so much as raised his voice at them. But just the thought of going to have to redress a situation with him was moving enough for them to get themselves together.
You know, this film really lays out the realities of incarceration. And Fox, I mean, you've said this. There are families behind people who make bad decisions. And yes, you've done the crime and now you do the time, but the pain and the trauma is real. What's the message you want people to take away from this film?
I think what Rob said earlier is that love never fails. Love is the life's only valid expression, and it dissolves everything that is not of itself. And then the other piece would be never give up. Anything worth having in this life is worth fighting for. Our families are worth having. Our families are worth having. And therefore, no matter what situation we find ourselves in, we must fight for them.
Rob.
My message is that people will walk away from the film empowered, because it's kind of like one of those David and Goliath moments where, you know, you go up against the system. And, you know, our family went up against the system of Louisiana, and we came out victorious on the end. That I'm hoping that this movie serves as a call to action to people.
Yes.
That they will start to take action and right the wrongs that they want to see corrected.
Mm-hmm. Rob and Fox Rich are the focus of the new film Time. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a Master's in Engineering and Management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology, with over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience. Join a virtual info session on Wednesday, October 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
It's been a record-breaking wildfire season on the West Coast, with more than 500,000 evacuations and tens of billions of dollars in property damage losses. Firefighters are exhausted and resources are limited. So authorities in California are testing a new fire modeling technology to help. Prachi Patel of IEEE Spectrum has more.
The August Complex Fire in the Mendocino National Forest is on record as the largest wildfire in California's history. And as firefighters try to manage it, they call in David Buckley for support.
That typically involves using our software to run fire behavior analysis, spread predictions.
The company makes software that predicts how a wildfire will spread in real time. When a fire starts building, analysts need to decide where to send firefighters and resources. Buckley says his company's software can help make those calls more timely and accurate.
All of us are used to having smartphone applications that show weather and show Doppler radar hours in advance. Well, why can't we do that for fire?
TechnoSilva uses existing fire behavior models, adds hourly forecasts of weather and vegetation moisture, runs computations in the cloud, and gives results in 20 seconds. Old government software needs hours to run.
All right, can you see my screen?
I can, yeah. Buckley shares with me a screen that shows a 3D map of California.
Yeah, so this is a 4D environment.
The fourth dimension for 4D is time.
So you have a mapping interface where I can zoom and pan, and I can actually turn on different layers.
The software simulates what would happen if fires start at points 1,000 meters apart across the entire state. That way, analysts can see the highest risk areas even before fires start. There are blobs of different colors on the map.
So these purple areas are the areas, if a fire ignites there, we know it's going to be over 10,000 acres without any suppression. So these are my high-risk areas for fire igniting.
Suddenly, an alert pops up on the screen.
There's a little red dot. So a fire just started right there.
A new fire just registered on CAL FIRE's dispatch system, which is linked with Buckley's software.
So what we do is we automatically will simulate a fire from there because we have the weather. We know the ignition location. We have the weather. We have all the terrain and fuels characteristics.
For every fire that breaks out, the software predicts its path, size, and impact on people and buildings. Then it assigns a 1 to 5 rating to help intel officers decide which fires to target. One could be big but in the middle of nowhere. Another smaller one could encroach on buildings. More than 100 CAL FIRE officers are already using the software.
CAL FIRE, Scope.
Deputy Chief of Intel Philip Selig is one of them.
It helps us come up with a plan.
Of course, predicting wildfires, like weather, isn't exact science. But Selig says software can be a valuable supplement to training and experience.
So as we're modeling, there's no one model that's 100%. What they are is tools. So we utilize this as a tool to enhance our understanding of the potential spread or threat that that fire might propagate to.
Daniel Lavelle, a fire specialist at Oregon State University, says the software could be a valuable training tool, kind of like flight simulation training for pilots. And with fires getting more frequent and devastating, Lavelle says firefighters need all the tools they can get.
And if the technology can help us do that for training, for simulation, for prevention, for pre-planning, terrific. We need to utilize it.
For Here and Now, I'm Prachi Patel.
A Virginia judge has extended the state's voter registration deadline until midnight tonight after a construction crew cut a fiber optic cable earlier this week and temporarily brought down online voter registration along with it. The unexpected disruption comes in a state with very close congressional races this year, including in Virginia's 7th congressional district. Incumbent Democrat Abigail Spanberger is facing Republican Nick Freitas. And that's where we're going to turn now for the next Here and Now district profile, our look at key House races across the country. Ben Pavier is politics reporter at Virginia Public Media in Richmond. Hey, Ben.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thanks. So first to the underground cable, we should say accidentally cut during work on a utility project, but it did put a stop to online registrations just ahead of that deadline. What could it mean for some of those key races in Virginia?
You know, it's unclear because we just don't know how many people were affected, which is, I think, why a federal judge agreed to grant a 48-hour extension on voter registration. The system was out for a number of hours on Tuesday, and so, you know, people who were trying to access that just couldn't do it. And there was also some snafus with early voting. Some registrars required people to cast provisional ballots. There were problems with the DMV and unemployment, so it was just a very messy situation.
Yeah. All right, let's get to the race in the 7th district outside of Richmond. What can you tell us about that district, politically speaking?
So this is a district that was drawn to benefit Republicans. It's kind of to the west of Richmond. It includes some of the Richmond suburbs, and then it kind of slopes out into the surrounding counties. For years, Eric Cantor held the seat, a very senior House Republican. He was unseated by Dave Bratt, a Tea Party Republican, who held onto the seat for a couple terms, but became sort of unpopular with a lot of moderate Republicans, other people who found him to be kind of brash. And Abigail Spanberger, a former CIA operative, unseated him in 2018 by less than 2 points. And so she is now defending her seat in 2020.
And she was part of the blue wave that took control of the House from Republicans back in 2018. Here's a recent ad from her.
In Congress, I'm working with Republicans and Democrats to serve national interests, not special interests, passing laws to strengthen border security and to protect America from future dependence on Chinese technology that could leave us vulnerable to hacking.
What's her first term been like in Congress, and what's she running on this year?
So Spanberger has attempted to make good on promises she made in 2018 to be sort of this person reaching across the aisle to try to bridge some political divides. She's focused a lot on healthcare and broadband. And it's kind of a difficult message right now. I mean, Washington's deadlocked and she's been able to get some stuff through, but I think she's sort of picked her battles with Trump. She's hasn't always towed the line with her fellow Democrats. I think we see that right now in these COVID-19 relief negotiations where she and a group of other people in this sort of problem-solving caucus are pushing for a deal. There seems to be less eagerness from Nancy Pelosi and some of the rest of the caucus. So, you know, she's occasionally bucked her caucus. Her Republican opponent would say she hasn't done that enough, and really she's just your average Democrat.
Well, let's hear from her opponent, the Republican Nick Freitas, a former Green Beret. Here he is in an ad talking about his reasons for joining the military.
My mother was a nurse. My father was a police officer. My mom always looked at things as if somebody is hurting or somebody needs help, you have a personal responsibility to intervene. My dad really instilled in me this idea that you have an obligation to protect people that can't protect themselves.
Tell us more about Nick Freitas. Is he a Republican in the mold of Donald Trump?
You know, I think he's a slightly different kind of Republican. He's always had a kind of libertarian bent. He served two tours in Iraq, and then he became a state legislator in 2015. And so he's known for taking sort of a very free market, hands-off approach to government. A notable thing about Nick Freitas, I think, in his political career has been his problems with paperwork. In 2019, he missed a deadline to file his campaign paperwork in a very safe Republican district and had to mount a very expensive $500,000 write-in campaign. And then again this year, when he's running for Congress, he missed the deadline again. In this case, he was granted a reprieve by the State Board of Elections because a number of other people also made that mistake.
Now, if I look at 2016, President Trump lost Virginia, and he is behind by, it looks like, quite a bit this year as well. That would usually be good news for down-ballot Democrats. But what do the polls say about the future of the 7th District? Because as you point out, this was a district that traditionally has favored Republicans.
You know, I'm not aware of any formal polls. The internal polls that I've kind of gotten glimpses at show a pretty tight race with Spanberger maybe having a slight lead. You know, the Cook Political Report has moved it from a toss-up to a lean Democratic race. And I think the reason for that is the Richmond suburbs, which have really come out against Trump, voted against Republicans more and more often, and that constitutes a sizable part of this district. So, you know, if that trend holds, Spanberger might be looking pretty good. But we don't know what Republican Trump supporter turnout's going to look like in 2020. And, you know, as you said, he won this district in 2016. So if his supporters show up in the way they did in 2016, you know, I think Nick Freitas has a pretty good shot.
Ben Pavier, politics reporter at Virginia Public Media in Richmond. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, more than 17 million Americans have already voted in the 2020 election, and a good number of those people are casting their ballots for the very first time in their lives. And we're going to take a few minutes now to hear from three of those voters, starting with a registered Democrat in Texas.
My name is Gustavo Payan Luna. I am in El Paso, Texas right now. I grew up on the Mexican side of the border with El Paso. I work in international development and education, and I am 43 years old. And the reason why it is the first time that I am going to cast my vote in the U.S., and the reason why I care is because a little over a year ago, there was a shooting in El Paso that killed over 20 people and left many wounded and many emotional scars. That shooter was targeting Mexicans. And one of the reasons that we know this happened is because Mexicans, immigrants, Hispanics are demonized, you know, with an intention to gain political power. I am hopeful in terms of the election. Everything from the process being transparent to the outcome in terms of why, of what I expect and what I think and believe is the best for the majority of people in this country. I agree that nobody has to agree on everything, but what we think is best in terms of unifying the country. And I think we have to keep that faith and that hope so we can actually move forward.
Hi, my name is Carly Hahn. I am 21 years old and a senior at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota, and I am joining from my hometown of New Prague, Minnesota. I am just really excited to vote for Donald Trump and Mike Pence because in the past 4 years, I have been really happy with their signing of the USMCA and that they support law and order. That is one thing that concerns me in Minnesota with the riots this past summer. And then the other huge thing for me is recently Donald Trump signing the Middle East peace deals with Israel, especially because it's something that the Obama-Biden administration said was impossible. If Trump does get elected, I'm really excited to see him expand on what he has done. I also think that we have gotten into this habit of talking to the other side like they're not humans. But if we can really understand why we believe different things, then the only way to find common ground is to hit that point first, because we can never find common ground if we don't understand why people believe what they believe.
Hello, my name is Julie Ben-Moshe. I'm 33 years old from Richmond, Virginia, and I am a registered nurse. I've purposely never voted. It's been kind of my protest vote for not agreeing and not feeling like I had a candidate that represented me. I don't affiliate with either party and never have. However, I don't see in Donald Trump a leader, and I don't think he is fit to be the president. So we have to think broader than just our constituent bases and catering to them. So making sure that, you know, not just the global health with the pandemic, but also making sure the affordable healthcare is accessible. I have cancer. Our health is important. If we don't have health, we really don't have the foundation to do much else. I think no matter who wins, there is going to be a very uncomfortable protest situation. The seeds of doubt of whether this is free and fair have been sown, whether or not that's the case. If I can finally go in and fill in my ballot, I think anyone can. And if you have to hold your nose, do it.
Three Americans voting for the first time in a U.S. election with a message for us all. Go vote.
The Los Angeles Dodgers may have saved their season last night. They scored 11 first-inning runs on their way to a 15-3 win over the Atlanta Braves in Game 3 of the National League Championship Series. The Braves had won the first two games. Mike Pesca is sports analyst for Here and Now, and he hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. And Mike, teams don't generally come back when they lose the first three games of a best-of-seven series. This was a huge win for the Dodgers, wasn't it?
Yeah, when you say they generally don't do it, it's only happened once in the history of baseball, which okay. is, you know, a century-long yes. history, right? And Red Sox and Yankees fans will remember that from 2004. So this is a do-or-die game, and I think the Dodgers just said, let's not even create a lot of doubt. 11 runs in the first inning. We'll be playing a few more games.
The Braves and the Dodgers are playing in Globe Life Park in Arlington, Texas, and there were actually fans in the stands. How's that working?
Well, I don't know how it's working because, you know, the other series, so what baseball did is the first round of the playoffs, teams played in their own parks, but now they're bubbling so that the teams are playing all their games in either California or Texas. And the American League series is in California. Now, in Texas, such similar states and yet different rules, because in the California series, in the American League, there aren't fans in the stands. I'm just looking at the latest statistics. Mm-hmm. In Texas, 847,000 cases reported, 5,000 new cases yesterday. California, 867,000 cases total reported, and 3,000 yesterday. So there's California dealing better with the virus, a more populous state, the two most populous states. But it's California that is banning fans, not Texas, which tells me that there's a lot of politics and political decisions going into this.
Yeah. Okay, something else. The Tampa Bay Rays lead the Houston Astros 3-1 in the American League Championship Series. Now, there aren't any fans in those games, which are being played in San Diego, because, of course, as you just mentioned, California has more COVID restrictions than Texas. But what's jumping out to you from this series?
Well, this is a series. If coming into this season or coming into this truncated season, you would say that the Astros are one of the best teams, but they were, of course, involved or perpetuated this cheating scandal. Though, if you look at the regular season record, they actually wound up a losing team. A lot of teams were able to make the postseason, even with winning records. They're a much better team than their record indicates. But I think they must be a much more loathed team than we even knew, because yesterday, during the Amy Coney Barrett hearings, Ben Sass of Nebraska, not a Rays fan, took the time to call the Houston Astros cheaters. He called out the two Texas senators by name, and he used it to phrase a question about cheating in sports and cheating in the law. But the fact that this is seen as such a political winner that even a Nebraska senator can beat up on the Astros and everyone will nod and say, oh, yeah, those dastardly Astros, that tells me something.
We've also been talking to you about COVID-19 and football, and the NFL has had a couple of games postponed because of positive COVID-19 cases. How is the league responding to that?
It's so hard for the NFL to bubble. There are hundreds of people associated with football teams between staff and players. So I would say they're doing the best they can. And when there are positive tests, one test, they sort of hold their fire. But if there are more than one positive test, they close down facilities. So we just saw the Tennessee Titans go through this for a couple of weeks, and they played a Tuesday night football game, which is not a thing that happens except under extraordinary circumstances. Now the Atlanta Falcons have had a couple of positive tests and their facility is closed down. So there's this massive rejiggering of the schedule. It's extremely imperfect, but I would say given the circumstances, the league is responding, at least in terms of scheduling and enforcing of rules, as best they can.
But then there's also college football, where two dozen games have already been canceled because of coronavirus. What do you think the rest of the season holds for college football?
It's going to be jumbled. And Nick Saban, the coach of Alabama, you know, the most successful coach in college football, he has been diagnosed as COVID positive. So the SEC, they've canceled the University of Florida game. They're going to be scheduling that game between two juggernauts, Florida and Louisiana State, for December, a week before the conference title game. Again, it is a tough thing because they're playing college football, you know, the South sport and America's sport in some ways in America and in regions that are experiencing what the demographers and the experts are describing as perhaps a third COVID spike. There's no good way to do this.
Yeah, I have less than a minute with you, but I wanted to know if you had any thoughts about the great ball players who have passed away this year, including Joe Morgan, the Cincinnati Reds Hall of Famer this week.
Yeah, we've lost Whitey Ford and Bob Gibson and Lou Brock and Tom Seaver and Al Kaline, Hall of Famers, and just even, you know, top tier Hall of Famers, all of them. Mm-hmm. And I have to wonder, most of these deaths, in fact, none of them have been attributed to COVID, but I have to wonder if that plays a role. It is nice, though, to be able to reflect on the greatness they gave us during their lives.
Yes, Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. As always, thank you.
You're welcome.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here Now.
Roller skating is having a moment again. Demand for skates is so high, it's even hard to find a pair. And for a growing number of people, it's also a way to advance social justice. That's next time on Here and Now.